The next case on the Southern Panel's argument calendar today is Carla Barber versus D281 Westwood, Inc. et al. Are counsel ready to proceed? Okay, go ahead.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Sterling. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Carla Barber. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay.
This is an employee misclassification class action by exotic dancers who worked at Treasurer's Gentlemen's Club. Primary allegation is a violation of the minimum wage amendment to the Nevada Constitution, which is an initiative petition ratified by the voters in 2004 and again in 2006. There are many sub-issues, I think it's fair to say, but there's two primary issues before the court today. First, did the trial court err in summarily determining that dancers are not employees as a matter of law? Second, did the trial court err in refusing to certify a class under Nevada's Rule 23? We submit the answer to both questions is yes. The trial court's orders directly and clearly conflicts with this court's binding precedent on both issues, and those decisions are in turn consistent with a vast body of case law from other states and in the federal parallel federal realm. On the certification issue, we ask this court to confirm, as other courts, as every other court has confirmed, that this type of question, whether a putative employer needs to pay a minimum wage, is the most perfect question for class action treatment. On the merits question, we ask this court to confirm, as it did in the lead case of Terry versus Sapphire, that dancers are employees because they are economically dependent on the clubs in which they work for employment. We ask the court to reject the effort by this club, as the court rejected the effort by the club in the Sapphire case, to characterize dancers as quote-unquote independent entrepreneurs who merely lease space in the club, who pay the club to lease space to perform as unlicensed independent contractors or independent businesswomen.
Mr. Sterling, couldn't you, it's clear that Treasurer's read Sapphire and made distinctions and areas of concern to the court and adjusted their own employment contracts and methods of running the business in efforts, it would seem, to distinguish their situation from that in Sapphire. What more would they need to do unless you're just determining that across the board these people are always employees? Can they be independent contractors, and what did Treasurer's do? Could Treasurer's do differently if that is their goal?
Justice Pickering in Sapphire actually addressed this question in dicta. She said the notion that dancers could be anything other than employees is a, quote, extremely tenuous proposition, given the fact that so many courts with so many various iterations. Again, the first case that we found to decide this issue is the Alaska Supreme Court decision in 1987. Since then, we've had Fourth Circuit, Fifth Circuit, and dozens of district court cases. And in each of those cases, of course, the lawyers are doing exact, for every case, the lawyers for the clubs are trying to come up with plausible denial or a way around it. The only way to do that, if you look at the economic realities test, is to focus on control.
But we have a statute, so we have 6080155.
We think that's a complete non-issue, that we agree with the trial court that for numerous reasons, a statute enacted 10 years after a voter amendment to the Constitution has no relevance to a constitutional wage claim for various reasons. The statute doesn't purport to interfere with the constitutional wage claim. The first six words of that statute say that it applies, quote, for the purposes of this statute. For the purposes of this chapter. It's an amendment in response to Sapphire, which dealt exclusively with Chapter 608 claims. Again, we agree that Sapphire was a Chapter 608 claim. This is a minimum wage amendment claim, and this court's confirmed in the Nettle, I believe, was the case, that it's a separate cause of action included in the Constitution, and therefore it must stand and fall on its own merits. I believe the, again, there's numerous problems that would arise if the court were to interpret this statute to apply to a constitutional wage claim. We don't think the court should accept that it does, as mostly the canon of constitutional avoidance would counsel against it. But it actually has come up directly in another case, Strickland, which we cite in our case, in our brief. In Strickland, there was an issue was how to interpret the recall petition process in the Constitution, I believe it's Article 2. A decision by the Secretary of State was made to interpret the Constitution. The legislature disagreed and actually directly enacted clarifying legislation to state, here's how we think the recall petition as it's defined in the Constitution works. And the Supreme Court in Strickland said, that's not the legislature's job to clarify the Constitution. They cite Marbury, that's our job. And they said very clearly, well, further, I mean, they rejected the efforts by the legislature. So again, if the legislature was intending to repeat Strickland, Strickland controls. I believe also Thomas is pretty clear in terms of what the legislature can and cannot do with respect to the constitutional right enacted in the Minimum Wage Amendment. Again, we agree. Another interesting point is the parties agree that the Minimum Wage Amendment incorporates the FLSA's economic realities test. The only difference is the club suggests that the statute acts as a gateway threshold test.
Excuse me.
Again, for the various reasons we've run through in our brief, also preemption, of course, would be a massive problem. This court again noted in Sapphire, no other state has ever tried to enact to institute a state wage law regime that protects a narrower class of people that protect it under the federal counterpart. I don't believe there's a response to our conflict preemption argument. It's precisely analogous to having a federal law saying you've got to label drugs this way and a state law saying you've got to label drugs another way. The state law is preempted. The federal law controls. And again, we believe that that would apply to the statutory argument.
The statute, to follow on to this discussion, the statute says that a person is conclusively presumed to be an independent contractor if, and then a series of factors are laid out. How does that conflict with the express language in the wage amendment constitutional provision? So what language in that amendment or in that constitutional provision conflicts with the legislature's ability to establish what is or is not an independent contractor?
Yes, sir. We believe the best analogy would be, for example, to look at the First Amendment, which prohibits restraints on free speech. So free speech is a constitutionally protected concept. Conduct is not. And so by
Well, I'd like you to focus on the language within the minimum wage amendment provision, not some other constitutional provision, at least not yet. I'm asking you a very specific question. What language in the wage amendment provision conflicts with this statute?
The term employee and its definition in the Constitution. We believe the court, when confronted with, you know, it's clear the voters intended to protect something. And I believe this court in Sapphire said what voters intended to do was expand protections currently then offered under the state law. The concept of employee, the existence of a protection for, quote, employees was enshrined in the Constitution in 2006. And so the court, we believe, must first ask, who did voters intend to protect? If the statute then seeks to alter or minimize that definition, then that is the conflict.
Well, how does it do so?
Well, as the respondents have noted, it seeks to act as a filter, as a gateway filter.
So the voter didn't intend that everybody be an employee.
Absolutely
correct?
Not. And so, again, what we suggest is the only reasonable, and the Miller versus Burke is clearly the framework. Again, this court in MDC restaurants resorted to Miller versus Burke. What did the voters mean by health benefits? Again, the court there didn't look at clarifying legislation. The court looked to the text, the policy, and the history. And so we believe that if you look at the text of the amendment, there's only one possible interpretation of that definition, which is that it tracks the parallel federal definition. They're identical. So the in our brief we cite, it's the concept is, you know, we're using a term of art. It's tautological, as this court noted in Sapphire, the definition. An employee is someone who's employed by an employer. That's not very helpful. But that doesn't mean the court then looks to legislation to figure out what it means. The court looks to the text and notes that it is identical to the FLSA definition. That's a term of art that's been in place since 1938. It's well known, and courts will assume the voters intended that term of art to be used the same. So again, and we go through a whole other sort of, the Miller versus Burke analysis leads to the conclusion that the voters intended to protect the people who are protected by the parallel federal wage law. And so therefore, a statute cannot interfere with that basic.
But how does it interfere?
Because it seeks to, by definition, it imposes an additional hurdle, right? I mean, what they're saying is, so you determine that you're an employee by focusing on the economic realities test. But before you get to prove that, you've got to jump through the legislative hoop to establish that you're not an independent contractor. Well, and so again, I suppose it's just sort of a logical proposition that if an individual qualifies as an employee as a matter of economic reality, the only thing a statutory test can do before that is remove them from the protections of the economic realities test.
Seems like from your argument, counsel, then that you read the Sapphire decision as essentially holding 6080155 unconstitutional.
Sapphire,
I can't imagine, given your argument, that the statute would be applicable in any circumstance.
Correct, because it would be preempted. And again, the case would not be Sapphire. The case would be Strickland.
Sapphire didn't say that,
no.
Of course.
Sapphire would not be on point because it dealt solely with Chapter 608. Legislature is free to work with 608 with no restrictions, subject to federal preemption. Again, the federal preemption problem, if the voters hadn't spoken and all we had is Chapter 608, we'd still be in a bind. Because, and again, in Dicta and Sapphire, the court did notice this, which is you can't have a state law that is more restrictive than the federal counterpart. It can be more generous, but it can't be more restrictive. And so the federal preemption concern would be a problem. But again, the lead case is Strickland, and then I think also Thomas. So case in point with Thomas. In Thomas, this court was pretty clear. It was a big case, and they said, look, taxi drivers cannot benefit from the legislated exception that's been around forever because the Constitution controls. The message we submit from Thomas is not that the legislature could go back and ignore Thomas by saying, well, we'll just rephrase it as a threshold test. People who transport passengers for a fee in a vehicle are independent contractors. That would get them to the same result this court just told them they couldn't do because the Constitution is the supreme law of the land.
Okay, Mr. Sterling, you've got 1:19 left.
Thank you.
I'll add 2 minutes to your time for rebuttal. And Ms. Keel, did I pronounce that correctly?
Keel, like a boat.
Okay, great. I'll add 2 minutes to your time, to your oral argument time.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I would like to respond to appellant's attempt to force fit all the exotic dancers into this box of the $8.25 per hour minimum wage employee without regard to the actual facts in the record. Appellant seeks to disempower these women and deprive them of the freedom to operate a lucrative, independent business with the potential to make upwards of $200,000 a year working only 2 to 3 days a week. This court in Terry rejected an industry-wide presumption that all exotic dancers must be employees and left open the potential for exotic dancers to be found to be independent contractors in the right factual circumstances. The right factual circumstances exist here. In this case, the record shows that dancers at Treasures, shrewd entrepreneurs with the free to set their own hours, set their own prices, and control every aspect of their performance. In fact, Treasures prides itself on exercising the bare minimum level of control over these independent contractors. And one would be hard-pressed to find a single factor that Treasures could do differently to give even more freedom and discretion to the dancers. The question of independent contractor status under the minimum wage amendment is a fact-specific inquiry based on the totality of the circumstances. And the district court properly found the unique factual circumstances of this case overwhelmingly favored the conclusion that dancers at Treasures are independent contractors and not employees. Now, while the district court did err by adopting the Terry Economic Realities framework instead of the NRS 608-0155 statutory framework, that error was ultimately harmless, as either framework results in the conclusion that these dancers are independent contractors. And just to speak a little bit to the 608 framework, we have a matter of first impression before the court. What is the appropriate test to define an independent contractor under the minimum wage amendment? The minimum wage amendment, as noted in dicta in Terry, it said the definition in the minimum wage amendment of an employee was not helpful. It was tautological. And therefore, they had to look to something outside of the statutory framework of 608, which is the most analogous statutory framework, to give them a concrete interpretive aid. We no longer need to do that because there is something right in the statute that can be applied. And here, the appellants have not shown that there is a single meaningful difference in the iteration that would lead to conflict preemption. They haven't shown how the 608-0155 standard would be more restrictive. It's just a slightly different statement on a fairly common theme. And in fact, every federal circuit court that has heard the issue of what is the definition of an independent contractor has not applied the same exact six factors. Every court has said that those factors are guidelines, but have stated them differently. They've all said that these are not an exclusive list and these are not determinative.
So, well, if from your point of view, the chapter, the application of the chapter is harmless, it would have led to the same result. What's your analysis under the test in Terry then?
Our analysis under the test in Terry looks at the same factors that we had presented to the district court, and it looks to the degree of the alleged employer's right to control the manner in which the work is performed. And we found that all the evidence showed that we exercised the bare minimum level of control. The employee's opportunity for profit and loss, depending upon their managerial skill, was abundant within the record. In fact, when appellants try to point out the similarities of this case to Terry, they actually highlight significant distinctions between the two cases in the facts. At Treasures, there is no shift requirement. Treasures does not set shifts, minimum hour requirements, does not require a dancer to get permission before leaving. At Treasures, dancers are free to come and go as they please. At Sapphires, dancers were required to remain at the club for a minimum of 6 hours after they arrived. Sapphires also established minimum prices the dancers had to charge, discouraged the performers from refusing to give lap dances if a customer requested one, required dancers to accept dance dollars, and dancers could not ask the patron to pay in cash, and they had a laundry list of approximately 30 different rules and restrictions on appearance, clothing, heel height, what performances you could do, what you had to do during a specific performance, and they required dancers to give mandatory tips to some of the club's employees. Treasures does none of these things. Dancers set their own prices. They can negotiate deals, $5, $50, $500. Treasures does not set the price and does not take a cut of a dancer's profits. Dancers can refuse any customer and have no requirements on the number of dances or the types of dances they can give a customer as long as it is legal and not in violation of the law.
Doesn't it appear, though, the district court's finding on the factor regarding the opportunity factor for profit and loss? When Terry, quoting from Terry, it says, the dancers in her personal skills and solicit larger tips is no more dispositive of her opportunity for profit than a server at a restaurant utilizing her interpersonal skills in hopes of securing a larger gratuity. And then it goes on, the district court's finding, it seems, directly conflicts with Terry on at least that finding and a couple others. So what's your response to that? It does seem like the district court perhaps got some of these factors wrong, even though it had Terry.
Well, I would respectfully disagree, because at Sapphire's, they set minimum prices. They told the dancers what they could charge. So they were setting a baseline, just as a restaurant might set the price of a meal. However, at Treasures, a dancer can negotiate any amount they want for a dance. If they want to charge $5, or if they can charge $50 for a floor dance, they are free to do so. They are free to offer it two-for-one deals, or buy two songs, I'll give you the third free. The dancers can tailor the price to the customers. Appellant's hustling waiter analogy from Terry doesn't fit the facts at Treasures. A waiter is limited by the customers that are seated in his section. A waiter can't refuse to serve a customer because they have bad table manners or are not buying expensive bottles of wine. A waiter can't leave in the middle of his shift and disappear for 2 weeks on vacation. A waiter can't change the price of the meal because, in his business judgment, he thinks the customer will pay more for the same food. And a waiter can't negotiate a deal or a discount because it is the restaurant that has that food that is being sold, not the waiter. At Treasures, it is the dancer that is providing the service, and the dancer who determines what she wants to charge for the service she is providing. And so I believe that the district court correctly noted the distinction between the two, and therefore held correctly that the dancer was free to set the prices. If I look at someone and I determine, I think this person will pay $30. This guy over here, I think, is only going to pay $20. I'm going to go over here and I'm going to try and convince him to pay me $30 for the exact same product. That is the hallmark of an employee's ability for opportunity and profit and loss, depending upon their managerial skill.
Ms. Keel, the reason I asked you about this argument and the record is I really wonder whether NRS 608.0155 is implicated in this case. I know that was a position you tendered to the district court and you tender here, but if one analyzes the economic reality test contained in the Terry case along the lines of the record you've enunciated, it doesn't seem like one even gets to the constitutional collision that your colleague is talking about. Am I right about that?
Well, yes and no. In this circumstance, the court...
I guess stated another way, why is it necessary for this panel to even address 6080155 in resolving this case based on the record as you've articulated it?
It simply because that is the statute that exists and should have been applied by the district court, because following normal principles of constitutional interpretation, when there is an ambiguity in the Constitution, we look to analogous statutes. And 608 provides the analogous statutes and provides the test that sets the threshold conclusive presumption. If the dancer meets the conclusive presumption, you're done. You don't need to go any further because she's been conclusively presumed to be an independent contractor.
So on page 9 of the district court's decision, it enunciates the factors that it applied, six of them.
Mm-hmm.
How do those in 6080155 differ from the six factors that were identified by the district court in the Terry decision? What factor would be added or which one would be different? And how would it make a difference in the outcome?
We don't believe it does make a difference in the outcome, and we actually believe that the same facts speak directly to the three out of five.
Let's stick to a comparison of the factors identified by the district court out of the Terry decision. I assume you agree that the district court correctly identified those factors from the Terry decision.
We do believe that the district court correctly identified and ruled and weighed the economic realities.
So how do those six factors identified on page 9 of the court's decision at 1073 of the appendix differ from the statutory factors, and how would that make a difference here?
Well, the only factors that are different are the 6080155 mandatory requirements, which is the person must possess a Social Security number or has filed an income tax return, and the person is required by the contract with the principal to hold any necessary state business licenses or local business licenses. Both of those facts were undisputed in
your contract.
In our contract.
With the dancers does that, or mm-hmm. does those things. But
yeah.
Apart from those items you've mentioned, all the other factors seem similar to the statute to me.
To me too, Your Honor. They are very similar. They're just slightly different ways of wording what is essentially the same six-factor test as the three out of five criteria. We actually spelled out in our brief how all five factors could be found based on the same facts that the district court found. So looking to just the distinctions between these cases, I think the important focus really needs to be on distinguishing the facts at Treasures from the facts at Sapphires, because appellants continually try to argue that they're all the same. Every strip club around the country has been found to have employees. Well, frankly, every strip club around the country does it differently. We have a different business model. We are well aware of Terry, and we evaluated our business model and how we treat the dancers in light of that, and we found that, as the district court upheld, the dancers were independent contractors and under our business model, because we truly can't come up with anything that we could have done to exercise less control, to give them more freedoms to apply their business, to engage in their chosen profession. Unlike the hustling waiter analogy that is limited and restricted and can't leave in the middle of his shift, the dancers can do that.
Ms. Keel, I don't want to interrupt your thing, but do you think, the statute, 6080155 came out in response, essentially, to Sapphires. Should we be concerned, going forward, should we even be applying economic realities after 6080155 to make this determination, or should we always do both, or some combination thereof? Why doesn't the statute just knock that interpretation out?
Well, because the determination under the minimum wage amendment is a matter of first impression, and we look to a statute that exists at the time that said it was retroactive, so it applies to Carla Barber, that is where the analysis should begin. The clarifying legislation was a reaction, likely, to Terry, because they felt that the people of Nevada understood it slightly differently and wanted a slightly different statement of the determining
factors. So what's your
factors?
Position to counsel's argument that under the Strickland case and a couple others that the adoption of that statute by the legislature is contrary to the preemption expectations in the minimum wage amendment?
If the statute had, as adopted, created a conflict with the FLSA or sought to overturn or overrule a decision, it would be. But it's not here because it was just simply clarifying legislation, just spelling out a more concrete interpretive aid for the courts to use when applying that statute. It was always understood to be that way, and because it was a clarifying statute as opposed to a exemption or seeking to overturn something or correct something, it is the position of the respondents that it should apply as written, and you don't need to get to a conflict preemption analysis because there is none.
I just wonder whether it's necessary to get to that statutory alleged collision when the facts of the case seem to end in the same result under either test.
We believe that it
is. Are we venturing out in trying to answer the question about the constitutionality of the statute when under the test in Terry the results are the same?
We believe the results are the same under either test. However, we sought to apply what we believe to be the correct standard, but it ultimately the results are the same, Your Honor.
Okay, I understand your argument. Any other questions from panel members? Thank you, Ms. Keel. Mr. Sterling. You have 3:15.
Thank you, Your Honors. If I may address the last point raised by Justice Hardesty, the court's order under the economic realities tests simply cannot stand because there are numerous direct conflicts with this court's directions on how it should be applied. For example, the court says that it's not irrelevant that there's some subjective intent of the parties on the status. And Justice Pickering and Sapphire said that is beside the point. Very noticeably, every other court to consider this issue looks at the investment of the dancers, costumes, makeup, looks at the investment of the club, millions in leasing, marketing, advertising, and everything else, and says that points to dependent status. Again, the court, in applying this test, did the opposite and frankly said, we're not going to do the test that way. We're going to do it differently. Another important point to realize is the error the court made below on stipulations of fact as to control. This club, like every club before it since 1987, has noticed that control is the only way to get around this test as a matter of economic reality. All of the other factors, one points to the permanency, lack of permanency, it's a given, this court said, as every other court said, doesn't matter. Every other factor reveals the fundamental nature of the relationship, which is dependency. Dancers cannot hang a shingle, they can't just go out and lease a space and start dancing. That they have to work in the clubs. They're entirely dependent on the clubs for employment. The clubs audition them, and they show up to work. No other, a real business, you can't just show up to work and have it be there for you and start collecting money. That's what these dancers do.
People can dance independently.
Somebody
can hang a shingle and go dance independently, so to speak.
They would need to have an exotic dance establishment license. So they could do what the club could do. And then they would be independent. They would be independently licensed businesses. The other potential is perhaps having. We've seen there's one case from a while back in Oregon, where there was a leasing agency, and it was the company that leased dancers to the club, and it acted as the employer of the dancers leasing it to the club. But the model, my colleague said this is very different. But the basic model is the same. It's been rejected as a fiction. The notion that the model is that the dancers pay to come and be, the club is just set up to provide a venue. That's the basic model. That basic model is a fiction. Could they work it differently? Yes. They could pay the dancers as independent contractors. That's a possibility, but they won't. It's never been done. The only thing we have here is a club attempting to suggest that it's given its dancers freedoms. This court said you can't do that. That's a framework of false autonomy. I'd also note that the record, there's a massive error in terms of stipulating to facts. There's numerous conflicts in the record on the issue of control. Our position that doesn't change the outcome of the case, because no amount of self-professed sort of disclaimers on control can alter the fundamental economic reality of the situation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sterling and Ms. Keel, for your excellent arguments and your briefs. The case will stand submitted. The panel